Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome back to the Corbett Report. I'm James Corbett of CorbettReport.com. It is the third Monday of the month, and that can only mean one thing: film, literature, and the New World Order. And today we're going to be talking about that wonderful, chirpy, happy-go-lucky, feel-good, warm and fuzzy animated film from Studio Ghibli. Cancel all that. It's going to be a very depressing talk, and you're going to cry. In fact, if you're not already crying from just having watched this film, you should probably be looking in a mirror and contemplating why you are a psychopath who doesn't mind watching children die in a horrible, disgusting manner. So, with that as preamble, and I really do hope that you've watched this movie before listening to this conversation, because honestly, you're going to get a lot more out of it if you've seen the movie. But let's get into this conversation talking about Grave of the Fireflies, the 1988 anime film directed by Isao Takahata. And in order to do that, we have live here in Okayama, Brock West of
In Studio.
Yay, hey. In studio. Yeah. Well, as you can tell from the unbelievable rumbling in the background, no, we're out and about in Western Japan, but hopefully this will not sound too bad. But Brock, thank you once again for joining us.
Always a pleasure. Thanks for having me back. It's great to be back in Western Japan. I put a tweet out last night in the slightly typhoony climes of Western Japan, but it seems to be a much to do about nothing, thankfully. But it's great to be back. Great to see you again. We've been in Japan for a couple of weeks now and having a great time as we always do here. And especially this weekend, we've had a couple of days together, spent some time together. One night is a little bit more blurry than the other day for some reason. The first night we decided to go out in the town with your friends, and yesterday we had a lovely day spending some time with your son playing in the park, etc. So it's been really wonderful. But unfortunately, as you said, let's bring everyone down to this level. But you asked me a few months ago, you know, you were thinking of doing this film, Literacy New World Order, about Grave of the Fireflies, and I was happy to put my hand up for it, but the next day I was kind of like, oh man, I know what to expect with this now.
So you'd seen the film already at that point, right?
I had already, yeah. I'm a huge anime, whichever way you want to say it, fan. From back in my teenage years, the typical Pokemon and Dragon Ball Z, but then as you get a little bit older, I just kept watching it. And then I stumbled across this Grave of the Fireflies movie, not because I knew anything about Studio Ghibli at the time, but I was listening to a band called Raised by Swans. I think they're from Newfoundland, and their cover of one of their albums was the picture of the two main protagonists, and I didn't think of any of it at the time. A couple of years go by, and then I watched this movie, and then sure enough there was that same scene. So I kind of had already had an idea of what to expect, and the funny thing is the tone of that album too is very, very slow and very moody and very depressing as well. So it kind of they're obviously taking some kind of note out of the book of that one. So yeah.
All right, so when was the first time you watched it?
I would say maybe 6 or 7 years ago.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. And what was your first impression?
Well, sadness, really. I mean, just, and it was the first time I'd seen a Studio Ghibli movie. So actually, I tell a lie. I mean, the first impression I got from it was the beauty of the animation. I've never experienced or seen animation quite like it, and then to find out that it was made in 1988, that really blew my mind. But then, obviously, as you get more and more into the movie, the tone, you quickly forget about the beauty, the gorgeous animation, and you really get sucked in and you start to invest a lot in the two main characters. So so I would say going at the start of the movie, I was blown away by the animation, and at the end I wanted to cry softly and deeply into a cushion or a pillow or something.
Yeah. So I'll admit, I saw this I think the first time about 10 years ago, and I watched it at a time when I was just watching every movie I could get my hands on. And I had read about this, or I'd heard about it as, you know, one of the best anime movies. So I'm like, okay, well, let's give it a shot. And so I didn't really know what to expect. And I will admit, I am someone who never, ever cries at movies. And I cried my eyes out the first time I saw this. It was so unrelentingly sad.
Yeah.
The movie, the ending.
That's the strange thing. I mean, for people who haven't seen it, and I hope everyone who is listening to this will have seen it by now, or will watch it after they hear this, but it's amazing that such an emotional force can come out from an animation. You know, normally people associate animation with cartoony and things like that. They can't really draw out any human emotion, but this one really, really does that quite effectively.
It really does, and in fact, that brings up a point that the author of the book that this was based on, it's a semi-autobiographical novel by Akiyuki Nosaka, who I guess his sister really did die, but he survived, obviously, so they changed that ending. But he wrote his novel in 1967, and over the years, he had many, many offers to make it into a movie, and he didn't go for any of them. But then eventually, around in the 80s, Studio Ghibli approached with the idea to make an anime, and he thought about it. And after seeing the storyboards and seeing what they were doing with the idea, he thought, this is the only way to do this. You couldn't do it as a live action film because it would be too real with the sort of the children dying kind of thing, but also because you would never get children to act as convincingly as you could animate them in this movie, right? Right, because this, I mean, you're right. The attention to detail, and it's not just the drawing itself, but the sort of the movements, the actions, the little details, the things that happen that are tiny little things, but when they're playing in the bathtub with the washcloth and it, you know, bubbles up and that kind of thing, it's just those tiny little things that make it very realistic to the point where once you get over the initial idea that most Westerners would have, oh, it's just, you know, it's a cartoon for kids. Once you get over that and you start to get into it, it really completely sucks you into that world.
Yeah.
To the point where you really feel like you're experiencing it.
Yeah, exactly.
And so, I agree completely with Nosaka that this is the only way you could do this. And having said that, there have been two live-action attempts to make this film. Okay. One was in 2005, I guess it was a TV drama. And then in 2008, there was, I think, a theatrical production.
Did you see any of
them? I didn't. I have the theatrical version, and I've only skimmed through it, only just to see how they treated some of the dramatic, like the main dramatic scenes, you know, the death of Setsuko and things like that. And yeah, I mean, and from what I've seen, it really is like you can't get children to act as convincingly as you can portray it in animation, right?
Yeah.
Because children are just going to be acting like they're starving to death, and you can see it, right?
Yeah.
But here in the film, they can just portray it easily. So having said all of that, I guess the reason that we're talking about this is because it is my contention, my conviction, that this is, I think, the greatest war movie ever made. And I have a few reasons for that, but let's turn to an authority, an expert on this subject, the film critic, the venerable late deceased film critic Roger Ebert, who put this on his list of the best movies ever made and had this to say about it.
You know, I've seen a lot of war films, and many of them are exciting or moving or dramatic or artistically effective. And a few of them actually reach you at an emotional level and not just at the action level. I was amazed the first time I saw Grave of the Fireflies to find that I was actually moved just about to tears by this film. You know, I think people who don't know what to expect are going to be very surprised by it. So this film has an emotional breadth to it involving war and the kind of results of war and two victims of war. That is astonishing. I met a group of Asian filmmakers from Vietnam at the Hawaii Film Festival about 15 years ago who had come over with a group of their films about the war, showing the other side of that war. And I noticed that in none of their films did they ever mention the United States. It was just the enemy. And I asked them about that, and they said, well, we've had so many enemies over the years. We've had China, we've had the French, the Americans, who knows who's next. The way we look at it is, you know, we are we, and then anyone who comes to attack us is the enemy, but their identity is not so important as the fact that they are our enemy. I think maybe this movie is saying that firebombing is not a very precise way of going after the enemy. It's a way to destroy morale, it's a way to break down a nation's will to resist, but at the same time, Are we really thinking about people like this little brother and his even smaller sister when we drop those bombs? Or are we managing to objectify the Japanese as an evil race who deserve to have this happen to them?
So that's Roger Ebert. And in fact, I was influenced, I think, by his interpretation of this film the first time I watched it, and I read his review of it. And the more I thought about it, the more I realized this is the perfect war movie. Because think of every war movie you've ever seen. Every war movie is about, I mean, at best, if it's playing on emotion, on the emotional level, the only emotion it's tapping into is it's, you know, the band of brothers and one of your men in arms dies in battle or whatever. Yeah. Oh, fuck you, I'm going to get you, you know, yeah, that kind of. That's the emotional level of war movies. And they can be, I mean, there are some excellent war movies that have dealt with, you know, the realities of war in different ways, and yeah. I don't want to downplay
Full Metal Jacket, things like that, yeah.
I prefer Paths of Glory. Huh? Have you seen that one?
No, I have
not. Excellent, excellent movie. But, yeah, I mean, all sorts of good movies. But this one is the only one I can think of that, A, deals with it completely, 100% at the level of the civilians
yes.
who are living through this war, which is something that most movies don't even mention, don't even think about.
Yeah.
This one is completely about that. And it's interesting for being a Westerner watching this movie to see the war from the exact opposite side that we see in every war movie, which is, in this movie, it's the Americans who are the faceless, nameless enemy other that you don't ever see. I mean, all they are is just planes flying overhead. And there's no discussion of that. It's 100% about the Japanese and their perspective on this, which I think is also, I mean, for a Westerner who's seen all these Western war movies about the Allied side, it's really interesting to see that perspective. So for that, I think this was extremely interesting for me, and probably the most effective war movie. But interestingly, Takahata, the director, specifically said in 1988, this is not an anti-war film, in absolutely no way. I don't have the exact quote, but he was very certain about that. And I find that interesting.
Yeah, so do I, yeah.
But I don't know why he said that. I only seen that quote. I don't know the context of what he was saying.
Maybe the context is he wasn't trying to, as you said, there was the idea of the Americans, it really is so much in the background. And I think they're only mentioned maybe once or twice in the first scene, and maybe later on in the towards the latter half of the movie, but maybe that's why, you know, he's not trying to particularly cast any particular blame on the Americans and or the Japanese. But yeah, you're right. I mean, that's the thing that stood out to me. I said this is absolutely an anti-war film. You know, I can't wrap my head around how they would not see it that way. I mean that's one of the things you pointed out, is just that this was also the first time that it really hones in on children. A child's experience of what war is like. Not generals, not governments, not soldiers, but children. And it's so raw, and it's so brutal, and so visceral and brutal. And a scene I noticed where Saita and Tetsuko, I think the first wave of the initial firebombings, and they've lost their mother, and they huddle in like a sewer next to a lake or something, and you can really see for the first time the fear in Setsuko's eyes, he's shivering and shaking, and that's when you can really say, I mean, that's for me, I was like, oh, this is where the tone of this movie is going to be really going quite quickly. And it never stops.
Yeah.
It never really stops.
Yeah, it opens with his death.
The first line of the movie sets the theme for the rest of the film, so where sadly, our main protagonist is left to die at Sanomiya Station, which is for those who don't know, Sanomiya Station is in Kobe. So, I mean, this is where this whole film is.
I've been there many times.
Yes, and we'll be going back there for the third time in a few weeks. So I might even go to Sanomiya Station just to, I don't know if there's anything.
Step over the shadow of Seda's corpse. And you should buy some Sakuma candy drops.
Yeah, oh, true.
I have a can at home that I bought after watching this movie.
Yeah, I'll give them to my nephews, yeah.
Yeah. All right. Okay, well, let's go through some of this then. So it does start obviously with that scene where he dies in the station, but then it quickly travels back to, I believe, March 1945 is where this opens, with the firebombing of Kobe. And again, it's interesting for me because I've seen photos, and photos are widely available of, for example, even the aftermath of the firebombing of Kobe. You can actually see some of the pictures. And of course, they're kind of these aerial, wide, panoramic shots where you see just this vast expanse of kind of smoking buildings and bombed out hovels. And this movie, I mean, makes you really realize that every drop of every one of those bombs is affecting people's lives in a way that you can never see from a photograph like that, right?
Yeah.
It's so again, it's extremely effective that way. So we start right in the middle of this firebombing, the splitting up of the family, and it goes from there to them going to the school,
yes,
which is like a temporary shelter,
yeah,
right? And then they make their way to the ants?
That's right, yeah.
Okay.
The first thing I noticed from the initial firebombings there is this strange calmness over the mother figure. You know, she seems kind of placid about it, and it got me thinking, you know, is this due to Japan, you know, after years of war, you know, becoming the civilians becoming almost desensitized a little bit to the real dangers of what's going on. So, and maybe in the end, that's what got her, that's what was her downfall, the reason of her death, you know. So, but also, I mean, this is something I wanted to ask you too. Is that also something underlying in Japanese culture as well? Not so much in wartime, but just, you know, not to worry too much, just to keep going headstrong, you know, whatever we're told to do, we will do. And
yeah.
I know that's something interesting.
Right. But, yeah. I think that is part of, obviously, Japanese culture. It's part of what was the imperial conditioning, but
yeah,
it survives today, obviously. And I think it is just kind of, you know, head down, do what you got to do kind of thing. But I also read that as a parent trying to reassure their children.
Of
right?
course, yeah.
Yeah. So there's a multiple different factors playing into that. But yeah, you're right. Very, very calm, very placid.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then off to the temporary shelter where they lose sight of their mother, and that's where unfortunately that Saita finds out that Saita finds out that his mother has been hit and is in pretty much a unwinnable situation in terms of her life, and
it's pretty much dead.
Yeah, so it's brutal. But then you can see very quickly Saita instantly taking the role of the parent figure over Setsuko. And it's something that I noticed he does grapple with up until the very end of the film. Him being I'm not sure, how old is he meant to be in the film? Kind of.
He is third grade of junior high, which would be, I think he's 14.
Yeah, so there's a struggle between him being the only source of care for Setsuko now, but also his own fears and his own battle with also still being a kid, you know, and wanting to play. And there's that scene where Setsuko is really pining for his mother's care and wants to see her, but obviously she can't. And then you'll see Saita spinning around on the monkey bars or whatever, trying to cheer him up, and then sunsets. It's a really powerful.
Yeah, that was an interesting scene, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Because Setsuko's. Is she crying?
Crying or kind of sulking or having
sulking,
a tantrum.
Right.
Kind of, yeah.
And he's just like, hey, look at me, I'm good at this. And he just keeps doing it
Yeah, as the sun sets and in the background, you can still see the smoking ashes of the town. So, yeah, it's... And unfortunately, it only continues to get worse from there on in.
Yeah, that's actually one of the happier parts.
Yeah, one of the happier parts. I mean, there is these little glimmers of hope in the movie,
exactly.
You know, where
especially
with the lollies and the tin, you know, they're a constant source of happiness for Setsuko, and it really, unfortunately, you kind of know
where it's going,
and when that tin runs out later at the end of the movie, unfortunately, it's so there's these little signs of glimmer and hope, and you know, and this effort of them trying to at least achieve some kind of normality in this horrific situation, but it's
frustrated at every turn,
yes,
and mostly by the other adults, the adults around
them,
the people who you would think would be the people who would care for these children, who clearly do not. And so that brings us to the aunt, who obviously is, I mean, kind of the crux of the story in a way.
Yeah.
She could have saved their lives, and she didn't.
Mm.
There's a lot of different things to say about that. But first, let's read kind of what the aunt is experiencing here. Because I don't know. I think my first impression of the movie, the first time I watched it, I just kind of watched the movie and I thought, you know, it's kind of like a, you get that kind of Disney wicked stepmother kind of thing where it's just an adult who's just evil and is kind of the driver for the plot. But the second time watching it, I got a completely different reading of this because I really do understand the aunt and her character and her motivations. She's trying to take care of her own family with the little food that they have, and they're doing what they can for the war effort and all this. Yeah. And so she sees these children, she cares about them, she takes them in, she cares, she seems sad for them, but it quickly turns to, you're just mooching off of us.
Yeah.
And I guess I understand that, but it's still, one of the ways to read that is that that is a very interesting sign of exactly what it would or will, hopefully would not, be like in a war scenario like, you know, World War II or something, where the societal pressure to be part of that war effort is so complete, so total, that it could literally mean life or death. You can be castigated from society so completely if you do not take part in that war effort
even,
that you will die.
Even by your own family, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Even by your own family.
Yeah, it's something that I tend to think at the start, she is relatively happy and able to look after them, but mainly I think because Saita ends up selling his mother's kimonos.
Right.
And then they get a nice big bag of rice, which will see them through for a few weeks, and they get a jar of it, like a quarter of the thing, even though they were his mother's kimonos. And there is quite a heart-wrenching scene where Setsuko realizes that he is selling his mother's kimonos, and these are the last probably memories or physical things that they have left of their mother. And you know, there's a scene where he's just crying and screaming for it, not to sell it, please don't sell it, it's my mother's, you know. It's really, really hard, but there's no compassion, there's very little emotion coming from the aunt. You know, this is wartime, you know, and very quickly that relationship disintegrates, and she constantly reminds both a 14-year-old and a 3 or 4-year-old that they're lazy and useless and worthless because they're not pulling their weight for the country, for the war effort, you know, whereas the other relatives in her family are. So it's something that got me thinking. A couple of years ago in my hometown in Australia, there was some pretty bad floods, and our hometown was cut off for about a week or so. And this is obviously a strange or a completely different analogy, but within a few days, people were starting to fight and bicker over, because the supermarket shelves were empty because the trucks couldn't get through. And all of a sudden you see this visceral, this survival, I don't want to call it survival instinct, but you know, if I can't have something, no one else can. And apparently there was this woman in this supermarket, and there was 3 loaves of bread left on the shelves, and she grabbed all 3, and there was people lining up for bread. And everyone said, hey, what are you doing? You can't, you know, at least just have to take one. And apparently she rips open the other 2 bags and stomps on them and said, if I can't have all 3 of them, then none of you can have it. And it's this mindset that comes in when, obviously it'd be much more strenuous and much more severe in war zone, but when things change and when things become a little much more difficult, instead of becoming more open and more compassionate and coming together and, you know, trying to reach some kind of normality and some kind of understanding between each other, it goes the complete right. opposite way, you know. And I think for me, that's
it
even more. It can go the other way, and you know, it's how quickly we go from being civilized to every man for themselves. So,
yeah.
And you know, once again, it's even more reason to know your local, to know your neighbors, to talk to your neighbors, to know your local farmers, to, you know, to start creating these valuable connections.
Yeah, exactly. Well, yeah. Civilization is 3 meals away from revolution.
That's what
as they
yeah.
say. So yeah, no, and you're right. I mean, this is an extremely vivid example of that
course, yeah.
phenomenon. But yeah, and that's why it's so important to have the infrastructure set up before this type of calamity happens, mm-hmm. so that hopefully it's not people scrambling. But then you think of examples like in Volos, Greece, where they set up that exchange, the barter network, mm-hmm. To get around, because no one had euros, so yeah. they're exchanging services and things. So people can come together in calamitous events to create something, but
yeah.
it's much harder to do so. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I think you're right. I mean, it's survival instinct, it's the reptilian brain, whatever it is,
yeah.
kicks in, and people just go crazy.
Yeah.
Mm.
So once they're kicked out, but basically kicked out, or, you know, they're not longer...
You see, that's the thing. They're not really kicked out.
Yeah.
They choose to leave in the end, which is interesting. And again, is another part of the story, which I hadn't really considered the first time I watched it, but the second time it really stuck out to me, that the entire Setsuko Seda dying thing could have been averted if Seda had simply sucked it up and gone to the aunt and apologized. That's specifically said to him by that old farmer in the field. You know, just go and apologize, and he'll like, oh, he'll go ask someone else. And that's, I mean, that's interesting. That's really interesting. That's an extremely important part of the story, but it's never followed up on, right? It's never, like, that's never seems to be, like, that's the point of the story.
Yeah.
Although, maybe it is, the more you reflect on it.
Yeah.
But it's not. It doesn't seem like that's the driving part of the story.
I mean, I guess, with the writers and directors, I mean, what would have happened if he had apologized and gone back to the house? They just...
And now, this is interesting. Okay, I guess I'll bring this up now. So I was just watching a review on YouTube by Anime Abandon, who didn't like the movie.
Okay.
And... his reasoning for it, well, there's several things that go into this, but part of it is because Setsuko and Seda are not characters, per se. They're not fleshed-out characters that you care about them. It's just these are two children dying, and you care about two children dying, as you would sort of watching that any two children. They're interchangeable in that respect. And so he made the point that, well, I'm not sure if he made this point specifically, but it's kind of what I got the gist of it, is that Seta, if he had, after Setsuko died, maybe, had to go back to the aunt and apologize, or come to some sort of realization about his guilt and what he had done, as happened in the real life story, to obviously the man who ended up writing the novel, who had this incredible guilt about having survived and his sister dying, that could have been an extremely powerful moment to develop Seta as a character, as a human being. But that loses kind of just the horror and pathos of the ending of the movie as the way it is. And the point, this is the interesting point that Anime Abandon was making, was that this movie was released in 1988 at a time when Japanese youth delinquency and juvenile arrests and things of that nature were spiking. Throughout the 1980s, there was a huge spike in juvenile crime, and there was a big kind of moral panic that was going on about this. And it's kind of, I'm not sure if this was specifically stated by anyone involved with the production of this, but Anime Abandon was making the point that this movie was really, it was specifically targeted at the younger generation, at teenagers, i.e. the people who were at that time part of this moral panic that was going on. And he's kind of making the point that this movie is really about manipulating those children. Look, this is what happens when you disobey your elders. And you better appreciate what you have, because, you know, your elders didn't have that when they were growing up, and that kind of thing. So it's kind of like a moral panic type of movie in that respect. And when you put it in that term, it is, I suppose, I mean, it does make sense from that perspective, because these aren't really characters that go through any development. They're just, you know, sad creatures that you feel sorry for, and then they die. And it really does, this movie does have that effect on you of making you kind of obviously think about what you take for granted. And I remember for years after watching this movie, I would think about just having rice to go with dinner. And, you know, this is not something that I should be taking for granted. This is something that is, I mean, people have died, to starve to death through, you know, lack of this simple basic substance. And here I am complaining, oh, rice, plain rice, so how boring, right? I mean, and so it does make you think that, but the point is, maybe it was all part of a manipulation to make you think about that. And in that societal context of what was happening in the 1980s, especially when that was the peak of the bubble and the craziness of the Japanese economy at that time.
Yeah, that's an interesting way to look at it, isn't it? Just getting back to with Saito and his pride and not going back to the ants. I do wonder. There's this mythical father figure. Throughout the movie, of Saito and Setsuko's father, who's in the Japanese Imperial Navy, and you don't ever see him or hear him speak. There's only photos, and I think there's a flashback of the ship sending off. And I do wonder if that has any effect. Was the main reason behind Saito not, you know, he's the father figure now. He has to stand up, and he, for whatever reason, he thinks he's at a dead end at his aunt's place, and he's sick of being told. told that he's worthless and useless and he can do it himself and everything. And I wonder if that kind of militaristic ideology is from his father has come through, because there is quite a few flashbacks of like photos and in the cherry blossom season with the family and everything. Mm. And there's still obviously quite a lot of pride and reverence towards his father, yeah. Even though I think even by at the time of the start of the actual bombings, I'm sure the Japanese Navy was probably already well and truly on its way to being destroyed. Yeah, so, yeah. But there was no word.
Yeah, actually, that's an interesting part of the movie too, because the father really is this kind of revered figure that's kind of mythical almost, yeah. And you would think, perhaps by the logic of most kind of, if it was a Western kind of anti-war movie, you would think at some point maybe Seda would become resentful of his father, or, you know, he abandoned me kind of thing, or, oh, why did he have to go off to this stupid war kind of thing, but yeah, there is none of that. It never takes that turn.
No, never.
So it really, I guess in that respect, it isn't kind of the obvious anti-war movie that it could have been. There's never an attempt to demonize the people who are involved in this war. Mm. Because again, it's completely told from the perspective of the children.
Yeah.
Which again, I think was part of what Takahata, the director, was talking about. The part of what's appealed to him about this story is that it is this ninth grader, it's about children. And he made the point that in war movies, it's always about these kind of nearly mythical soldier hero figures that the audience generally, especially children, could never relate to, because they just think of them as these mythical people doing these, you know, brave, heroic things, and so it's not really about them. And that's what appealed to him about the story. It's about the children, and they could relate to the experience. Mm. But I guess part of that is that, again, from the children's perspective, they never really question the received reality of the war. They don't even question what it's about. It's just the enemy.
It's just the enemy. It's just the war. I mean, the only change is that when Saito finds out that his father is, in fact, has been killed, and the whole Japanese Navy is at the bottom of the ocean, and, you know, there's this moment of, and this was weeks ago, and he had no idea, you know, the lines of communication, obviously because they were living in this abandoned shelter or mine or whatever it is, which is where they go to after they leave the aunt's place. So that's interesting as well, that, you know, there's this shock, and I think that's where Saito really almost starts to lose hope a little bit. You know, that really gets to him once he's throughout the whole movie, he's waiting to receive letters and some kind of contact from his father, and then when he finds out that he's been killed, it's too much of a devastating blow. And once again, it just shows you that, you know, now these kids are orphans, you know, and struggling to survive in a country that is, you know, at the time, and it's something that I wanted to talk about as well, is, you know, the fact that Japan was, even at that time, and one thing that's interesting to me is that the there is no mention of the bombings, of the atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. This is solely about the fire bombings, which is interesting. And already you can see that even just in this small world that Grave of the Fireflies is taken from, Japan was really on its knees, you know. And it's something that you had an in-depth conversation with John LaForge a few months ago around the last anniversary of the A bombings, that, you know, was there really a need for it? I mean, and in my opinion, this movie just is another layer and another factor showing that this whole justification of the A bombings because of Pearl Harbor or whatever really was—it's really kind of ludicrous.
But there is that line where the uncle says something like, you know, now we're preparing for the invasion or whatever.
Yeah, yeah. So
I mean, the sense was that they would have fought to the last man.
Yeah, yeah.
And given Japanese tenacity, if they had been ordered to, I'm sure they would have.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So I guess, that argument still will continue to rage. But it is important that this doesn't even mention the bombing, the A-bombing, at all. It's not even mentioned. No. It's about the firebombings, yeah. Which is such a huge part of that last stage of the war, and one that we almost never think about, because it was probably, I mean, as disgusting and atrocious and horrific as the war crimes of the A-bombing and Nagasaki was, It's almost nothing compared to the firebombings, which killed many, many more people in excruciatingly grotesque ways and displaced and wounded many more and displaced many, many more into situations like the one in this movie. And it's something that, again, to get a handle on what that means and what that actually was as an experience is difficult to do. except through movies like this one, or if we start to put it into terms that the audience would understand. And in fact, this was something that was done really well in Errol Morse's documentary, where he was interviewing Richard McNamara, the Secretary of Defense under Kennedy, who was talking about the firebombings of Japan as the war crimes that they were. And he was talking about Curtis LeMay, who was the insane general who came up with the idea and implemented the bombings. And I just want to play a little clip of that part of the documentary where they talk about that and bring it back to the level of what it means in terms of the average person watching the documentary.
The choice of incendiary bombs, where did that come from?
I think the issue is not so much incendiary bombs. I think the issue is, in order to win a war, should you kill 100,000 people in one night by firebombing or any other way? LeMay's answer would be clearly yes. McNamara, do you mean to say that instead of killing 100,000, burning to death 100,000 Japanese civilians in that one night, we should have burned to death a lesser number or none, and then had our soldiers cross the beaches in Tokyo and been slaughtered in the tens of thousands? Is that what you're proposing? Is that moral? Is that wise? Why was it necessary to drop the nuclear bomb if LeMay was burning up Japan? And he went on from Tokyo to firebomb other cities. 58% of Yokohama. Yokohama is roughly the size of Cleveland. 58% of Cleveland destroyed. Tokyo is roughly the size of New York. 51% of New York destroyed. 99% of the equivalent of Chattanooga, which was Toyama. 40% of the equivalent of Los Angeles, which was Nagoya. This was all done before the dropping of the nuclear bomb, which, by the way, was dropped by LeMay's command.
Okay, so that's McNamara talking about the firebombings, which again is kind of the almost the forgotten part in some ways of this war. And of course there was similar, the bombing of Dresden. Mm-hmm. I mean, just horrific things that were done, but of course they were done by the victors, so yeah, they're not war crimes. And there will never be a Nuremberg for them. Yeah. But this brings me to a question I wanted to ask you, which may seem really simplistic, but what do the fireflies represent?
To me, they represent hope. It's in one of my notes, and it's when they're inside the shelter, inside the mosquito nets, and you know they've caught all these beautiful, glowing fireflies. And for some reason, the fireflies die. I don't know why that is. Maybe because they can't get out or something. But they slowly start dropping one by one. And I, during the night, while Setsuko is sleeping, I think Saito starts, you know, being a 14-year-old kid going through this, he's fearful and afraid and wondering where his father is, and he goes over to give Setsuko a hug, and Setsuko says, "Leave me alone." And it's in that moment that I think Saito really understands that there's this isolation and this abandonment by everyone who he thought cared about him and Setsuko. And then just after that scene, you see the last kind of firefly slowly burn out, and it's really from then on it's when Setsuko's nutrition and her health really starts to go down quite quickly. So I think I think that was the directors and writers way of saying that,
yeah,
you know, there's no turning back now,
right,
from this.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, they're clearly hope, joy, life,
yeah,
and kind of that wonder and everything. And yeah, as it dies out, obviously that's a portent for things to come. But and in that respect, I think they're the children themselves, because
yes,
they die so quickly,
yes,
and that kind of thing. That I think that's all quite explicit. But the interesting part was there's a point at which they talk about one of the firebombings. They're talking about the flames going overhead, and they're like, they're just like the fireflies. Mm. And you see the bombs dropping, and it's just like the scenes of the fireflies flying around. Yeah. You see that kind of,
and then there's also that other scene where Setsuko is, she's collected all the fireflies and is burying them in a little mass grave, and then there's that quick flashback of their mother being thrown into a mass, yeah, grave as well, which is quite,
yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so
I mean, there's multiple layers of,
yeah,
things going on here
of what they represent. Yeah, you know,
their death and life.
Yeah, I guess it's trying to explain the fragility of life.
Yeah,
yeah,
Yeah, very powerfully so. Yeah. Again, I think there is something to the idea that this is a manipulative movie that's more meant at a modern audience than it is to talk necessarily about history. Mm. But regardless, it works exceptionally powerfully well. Mm. If it is just a manipulative movie, it does that very well. Mm. And if it is, even if it's not meant to talk about the history, I think it brings it to a type of vivacious life in front of you that you could never, again, I don't think you could ever do this live action.
I don't think so.
I will commit myself to watching the live action version, but yeah. I almost don't want to ruin my experience of the animation. Speaking of which, did you watch the English dub or the Japanese original?
The first time I watched it, I watched the English dub, and then on our flight over here, I watched the Japanese one. And I will say, you know, most anime purists will say the only way to watch Japanese animation is with Japanese and just read subtitles, you know. And I am starting to understand that now. I used to, I want to read all the time and you know, blah, blah, blah. But now there is, I think, yeah, it's much more better to have the Japanese voice actors. Not that the English voice actors did a bad job with this movie. They did a great job. To have those.
Me being a snob at heart, I've always been kind of like, oh, I don't want to watch the dub. I want to watch the
English.
But I've heard, and I actually watched a little bit of the English dub. But I've heard the main criticism is the voice of Setsuko is just not realistic as a 4-year-old. And having heard what I heard, it was sounded really atrociously silly, actually, which defeats the entire movie. If you can't get into Setsuko's voice as a 4-year-old.
Yeah, I mean, and Setsuko's voice in the Japanese version is, even just hearing the children play in the park yesterday, it's exactly like that. You hear these cute things, Ni-chan. It's those things that really, as you said, bring you into that environment amazingly well, considering it is an animation. You know, it's those little things.
Speaking of little children running around. Sorry about that interruption, guys.
And even just some of the things that your son was doing yesterday, so strikingly similar, you know. Yeah. So
very, very realistic in a lot of ways. All right, I think those are the main points I wanted to touch on. But are there any other specific things you wanted to bring up?
No, I think we've kind of covered it. I mean, this is really just it's a movie that, you know, goes to the heart of it of what happens to children during war, and it's something that so easily gets lost in our own ideologies, and also the ideologies that we get forced down or that we follow, you know. But there's also, I think there is this little glimmer of hope towards the end, just after Setsuko is cremated and has passed away. Obviously, one of the farmers, or there's a man in the city that Saito is in, and he says, "Beautiful day in spite of it all, isn't it?" And that's something that's very Japanese, I've found, and it's something I've tried to have conversations with some Japanese people, you know, about what they think about Fukushima or the Japanese government or the earthquake and tsunami and everything. And 9 times out of 10, the response I get is that we've moved on, we're moving forward from that now. And that, I think, has both good and bad properties, bad sides to it.
Yeah,
but it's interesting, and that it was interesting to me that was so striking in the movie that despite the horror that has just gone on, you can still look up at a beautiful day and be appreciative of that in spite of
it's
it all.
It's also interesting to step back one layer from that and think of the Japanese animators and producers and directors making a scene in which that happens in a movie that's about this, where they're reflecting on the past. There's a lot of layers to that. It is. It is a very interesting moment, isn't it? Because we as the audience obviously see it from Seda's perspective, like, how could you possibly say that? But from his perspective, an awful lot of this one little tragedy has happened millions of times across the country. Time to move on. It's an interesting perspective.
So yeah, I mean, I hope this movie got, you know, people to really contemplate the ideas and the ideals behind war and what it really means at the end of the day, you know, and what we're doing right now, going back into the Middle East, you know, and by we, of course, I mean Western armies and governments, of course. But also, I hope this will change people's ideas of what animated movies can be, you know. I'm a huge fan of Japanese animation, and you know, even my wife is kind of gotten on board with that now. There is something that can be explained in these movies that can't be done through live action, and there's definitely more. There's hundreds and thousands of great anime titles that over wide-ranging genres as well, you know. Yeah. So TV shows,
absolutely,
movies.
So, yeah, don't go in with preconceptions. I hope this has busted them. I think so too. I've seen a few animes, and I think they are absolutely amazingly beautiful. Yep. And this is one of them. So, absolutely. I hope it does break some preconceptions. And this has been an unrelentingly sad and serious conversation.
Yeah,
so let's end on a happy note, or a funny note anyway. So this movie came out in 1988. I'm not sure when Studio Ghibli was founded, but it was, I think, around that time.
It would be in the 80s, I'm pretty sure.
And so this was one of the two movies that, or maybe there were more, but two movies that everyone knows was released in 1988. The other one being Totoro, which is probably the most famous anime movie of all time. And apparently, when this was given its original theatrical release, it was a double bill of Grave of the Fireflies and Totoro.
Oh, wow.
Which I cannot imagine watching those two movies together like that. You could not get more different. I mean, oh my God.
It's kind of like Saving Private Ryan and Finding Nemo put together, isn't it?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Which one would you put first and which one would you put second?
Well, are you going to hit him with the low blow first or the uppercut second? I'm not sure.
Oh my God, I can't even imagine that. So apparently this was not much of a commercial hit at the time.
Unsurprisingly, well, maybe.
But I guess merchandise for Totoro was more than enough to economically stabilize Studio Ghibli.
It's still everywhere today in shops. Yeah, it's amazing.
You can see. All right, so, well, I guess it's time for us to end this conversation, and you can get back to exploring Japan. And we were just noting the other day how everything here is just concrete everywhere, and part of it is because of what we just saw in this movie, with the firebombings burning up all of that traditional culture, and the concrete monstrosities were erected.
Yeah, that's just one final thing, is that, just like you said, unfortunately, a lot of these older villages and stuff were lost in the Second World War, but there still is gems out there, and my wife and I have been lucky enough to visit a couple of those places. And if you ever do come to Japan, which I hope some of the audience will come out and visit Japan, it's a beautiful country with beautiful people and food and everything to go with it. But do go to those smaller rural villages and get into the nature. I think that's where the real heart of the country lies.
Yeah.
Like in any country,
yeah,
I guess, you know.
I think
the cities are the bustling nervous system, but the
Tokyo could be in any country, but
pretty much, yeah.
But the rural places are unique.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's a beautiful country in anyways.
Well, thanks for having me, mate.
Thank you so much for being here, Brock. I appreciate it.
Thanks, mate. Cheers.
All right, friends, James here, all by my lonesome back in the palatial broadcasting studios of CorbettReport.com, by which I mean the other room of our two-bedroom apartment. And that, of course, was Brock West of APPerspective.net. I think I forgot to mention his website there in our conversation, but at any rate, it certainly will be included in the show notes at CorbettReport.com, so please do go there and follow it through to his excellent blog on geopolitics in the Asia-Pacific region, which of course is on a slight hiatus at the moment, as is our monthly series on the Asia-Pacific perspective, as he is here in Japan traveling around with his wife, enjoying the sights and scenery, and hopefully heading back to Australia safe and sound very soon so that he can help us cover what is bound to be the madness of the upcoming G20 in Brisbane. I'm not looking forward to that for a number of reasons, but it will be interesting to talk to him about that and the fallout from that. But let's get straight into the mailbag from this month's edition of the podcast, or more accurately, the comments and feedback from last month. But before we do so, there is some music playing in the background. For those of you who are wondering, this is courtesy of Yoko, who wrote in an email in which Yoko notes, quote, "A good friend of mine got such a strong impression from Grave of the Fireflies. You know, that light degree of psychological damage most of us get after finishing this film. Well, in his case, it never went away, ever. So he and his band decided to sample the audio track of the film and write a song that was included on their debut album called Yui. The band is called Childs, yes, a misspelling of children, and the song Mariana. And so thank you very much for including that, Yoko. I really do enjoy this tune, so I'm happy to pass it on to the audience. And of course, you can find the link in the show notes if you want to listen to the entire song without my voice rambling all over it. And we will also Just note from that very interesting email that I got in from Yoko in advance of this conversation, Yoko also notes that that a decision was made to go ahead and finally have children after listening to my overpopulation myth episode, which is just about the best podcast feedback I could ever receive. So once again, thank you very much for writing in, Yoko. I do appreciate that, as I do appreciate all the emails that do come in through the contact form on CorbettReport.com. Also, with regards to last month's conversation on Contagion, which we conducted with Tim Kilkenny of Revelations Radio News, we had a few comments in on CorbettReport.com itself from the subscribers of Corbett Report, including a very detailed and thorough comment from Fosca, which I would encourage you all to go and read. A lot of things to chew on in there, a couple of which I'll note. First of all, Fosca notes, the CDC has started a strange blog on zombie apocalypse in order to raise public awareness of emergency preparedness. And Fosca notes that this and the 2013 movie World War Z are much more of predictive programming than Contagion, I think. So I certainly do hope people will check out that zombie apocalypse meme if they haven't yet done so, because obviously, I'm somewhat detached, thankfully, from the propaganda Hollywood cultural programming mill, but I see it at least from arm's length enough to know that there has been a very interesting and marked increase in zombies as a cultural part of the cultural zeitgeist recently. So there's, I think, a lot to be said about that, and perhaps we will have to talk about that in a future edition of this podcast. But Simon replies to Fosca's comment, just to note about the 1918 flu pandemic, which Fosca talks about, and noting the role of aspirin in that pandemic, which is an interesting one, and I'll let you go and parse that from the comment that Simon leaves there yourself. Fosca also makes a comment asking whether people like Jeff Skoll can simply make media worth watching, like some of the films in Participant Media's roster of films. And this is, of course, something that Tim and I talked about in that episode of FLNWO, where we talked about Participant Media and its interesting role in admittedly creating works of propaganda, and it's admittedly founded and sponsored by this billionaire who's in the quote-unquote good club with Bill Gates and Warren Buffett and all these other so-called philanthropist billionaires. And we were obviously quite cynical about Participant Media and, you know, the real motivations behind it. But having said that, of course, we did note that Participant Media has done some genuinely good films that genuinely are worth watching, not even from a deconstructing the propaganda type perspective, but from actually watching the movies themselves. Things like The Internet's Own Boy, which I haven't watched yet, but which Tim assures me is a very interesting film. So there are some interesting films in there that I wouldn't ever recommend throwing the baby out with the bathwater. I'm sure Participant Media has engaged in some very valuable propaganda, quote-unquote, but it doesn't mean that there aren't some nefarious ideas that are being propagated by this billionaire club. And, well, obviously, one of them that comes to mind is Al Gore and the Inconvenient Truth garbage that was shoved down the public's throats a decade ago. And on that note, Eric Pachenik replies with a comment on the Corbett Report post there. Jeff Skoll, in his own words, and it's a link to the transcript of Jeff Skoll's TED Talk, where he talks, for example, about seeing Al Gore's presentation and being blown away by it and deciding then and there that it had to be turned into a film. And then he goes on to brag that the Inconvenient Truth is now mandatory viewing in schools in England and Scotland and most of Scandinavia, and we've sent 50,000 DVDs to high school teachers in the US. It's really changed the debate on global warming. And then he goes on to compare Al Gore to the George Clooney of global warming. So that's an interesting little comparison for a number of different reasons, and I'll leave that you guys to parse that one. But anyway, again, I think it's definitely not so straightforward that we should dismiss anything that Participant Media produces, but as always, we have to have our thinking cap on and realize when we're being sold a lie. And on that note, we did get another comment on that blog post from Chris Weston, who writes, as a record producer, I am well aware of Abu Dhabi Media. They part own the company Vivo with Google and the utter scum that own my back catalog, Universal Music Group. And he wrote a blog about that, so you can follow that link if you're interested in reading about that story. But he says, this deal is evident when you go on YouTube. Try browsing music videos on YouTube without Vivo being shoved in your face. But it goes further than that. Take the song Stay With Me. The title has been used by about 50 different artists, including The Faces and Al Green, but have a look at a Google search for that title. 7 pages of results from some crappy unknown Vivo artist before one mention of Al Green or Rod Stewart.
So it's clear these companies are all in bed together, altering your perception of things on their websites to earn themselves cash. You thought Google ordered results on popularity, didn't you? Nah, they just do whatever makes themselves the most money. To hear Participant Media are doing a deal with Abu Dhabi Media makes me highly suspicious. Not that I wasn't already, but it went up a notch, as you can see from this small example. These people are not to be trusted. So thank you for that comment, Chris. I think that's a very good way of helping us to see that there are things that go on behind the scenes that we often wouldn't even consciously register or think about that are being subtly manipulated as a result of this confluence of money and power that is enabled by these mega corporations and the mega billionaires behind them getting in bed together and altering the web as we know it in ways that are subtle and quite insidious. So that is a good way of putting in a microcosm, the macrocosmic picture of the problems that can result from this type of power collusion. So something to cogitate on. So I once again, I do want to thank everyone who is commenting on CorbettReport.com, on the FLNWO series, and every other post on Corbett Report, all the videos and podcasts and episodes. Your input is obviously appreciated, and I'm very, again, very, very happy with the type of discourse and conversation and back and forth that's going on in the comment section there. So please keep it up. And if you are a subscriber, a member of CorbettReport.com, and you have not received your login details or you're having problems logging in, please do get in touch. That is what I'm here for. I'm happy to help you, because for some reason or other, I realize my web server is being blocked as some sort of spam by a number of email providers. So some people are having problems getting some of the auto emails with their login details, etc. So anyway, just get in touch with me if you're having those types of problems. And I think that's going to do it for this month. So I'm very much looking forward to talking to you once again next month, obviously the third Monday of next month, where we're going to be talking about Torah. So I will, of course, as always, include a link in the show notes so you can go and follow that and get prepared for next month's conversation. And until then, I'm James Corbett of CorbettReport.com. Looking forward to talking to you again real soon.
That was the night I died.